seamen on West Coast ships were those in the Marine Cooks and Stewards or in the Stewards Department. They were the people who were feeding the crew and serving them and cooking the food. Many times they'd be more than half of the Marine of the Stewards Department. Both the MFOW and W and the Sailors Union had people with very dark skins from Hawaii, some of them, and other islands, but no Afro-Americans.
What about Latinos?
There were Latinos. There were people of Spanish origin. There were people of South Sea Island origin. But African Americans were kept out, effectively.
What was the sailors' attitude about African Americans? Was it the employers keeping them out, or was it the unions keeping them out?
I never heard of the role of the employer. The union itself was the big instrument in keeping the industry, the deck, and his friends, absolutely without any African Americans among them. And the same in the MFOW. The whole idea was there was some stigma to having blacks that close to you, sleeping in the same room, the old crap. And Lundberg, when he split from When he became the voice of anti-communism in the in West Coast Maritime, switched when the war came, he very quickly switched from being an anti-communist from the left to an anti-communist from the right, and without any left politics to base his politics on, he very soon made the base for the bureaucracy that he was leading a racist. Racism was the big thing. We got to keep this a white union.
Khrushchev had always been one of the louder voices of, against anti-coolie labor. So was that reflected in there being no Asians on the ships?
There were Asians.
There were Asians.
Yeah, there were Japanese. Japanese Hawaiians in particular in the Sailors Union. Hawaiians, anybody who was a native of Hawaii or had lived there a long time was legit. Matter of fact, the Hawaiians became the strongarm group for Lundberg.
Did you get back to Los Angeles?
It was through Lundberg that Hal Banks became a force again in Maritime. Hal Banks had finked a 34 strike on a ship called the SS Hollywood here in Pedro. I'm told that he was convicted of killing a messman and had served hard time in Folsom. But he emerged again as the head of the SUPSIU tanker office in Richmond, California. And he told me personally that he was a member of the Klan and was licensed to carry a gun. And it was after the Union oil tanker campaign against the NMU, in which all the bad racism and everything came out, that Hal Banks went to Canada and broke the Canadian Seamen's Union strike after World War II by putting union cards in the hands of scabs. And
you say Hal Banks was working for Lundberg?
Yes, Lundberg is the one who put him back in business and made someone out of him. And then he went on. Finally, Canada wanted to kick him out of the country. He had been guilty of violence against some people, I'm told, and he knew that he was going to be in trouble. The story goes that he had bought the Dodge family, Dodge Brothers cars, family's yacht, and he disappeared from the east coast of Canada on that yacht and appeared in the Potomac and anchored there at a yacht harbor. And Canada wanted the U.S. to extradite him to Canada. And the Secretary of State under Johnson, I forgot his name, a liberal.
Not Dean Rusk, no.
Yes. Dean Rusk refused to extradite Banks to Canada to face the charges against him. And
You mentioned earlier something going on with oil tankers in Lundberg and a lot of racism came out. What exactly was that?
Well, when we were trying to organize Standard Oil of California, those tankers, that was 1943-44, the older men couldn't get hired by Standard. Because they knew if you'd been going to sea that long, you were probably Union on the West Coast. So the word went out that the young men should try to get on at Standard Oil, and we would then try to organize a big vote for SIUSUP. So I went. It took you all day to go through the red tape over in Point Richmond in the refinery. Took your picture, this and that. Then you went out and you got on a trolley, a little streetcar. It was only about 3.5 feet wide and about 10 feet long. And it was lattice work. You could see everybody in there. It was visible. And at the when you got to the pier, the doors opened electronically, and you went down it like a cattle chute into a little guard shack, and they frisked you down. And you went out the other exit door to the little guard shack, and the trolley moved up, and you get aboard again, and electronically the door closed behind you, and you would go out then all the way out to the hotel and the cafeteria on the end of the Richmond Long Wharf. The hotel and cafeteria had been put there in the 35 tanker strike to service the scabs. But they were used for relief men and so on during the war. So I looked very innocent and very young, and they found out, they saw I knew something about seamanship, so they made me assistant dock bosun. And I was planting our guys on various ships, don't concentrate them anywhere. It was my job to say, you're next and you go on that ship.
You were planting Union guys on
ships. Yeah. I mean, here I was working on the dock, running the ships and servicing the ships, and I would see one of our guys and I would see to that he got on that ship, my recommendation. But then I found some guys who were agitating for the Sailors Union. I overheard them on a racist basis. And I got this one aside around the back of the cafeteria and nailed him and demanded to know where he was from and where he got this line. And he admitted finally that he had come through the Richmond Tanker Office and he was sent aboard by Hal Banks. The first I knew about that office and that man being there. And I immediately went to the phone and I phoned Lundberg. And I said, I'm told that Hal Banks is in the tanker office and he's sending men out here. And they're doing it on strictly a racist basis. And Lundberg started to stutter. And it was tacit admission that what I had said was absolutely correct. I asked Lundberg what he's going to do about it. He said, well, you got to give the guy credit. He's doing a good job for the union. I said, that's all. And I hung up. And I got myself put on a ship he got away from the dock and finished out the a couple of trips on that tanker that I got aboard. And I voted union. And after I did my vote, I got off. And Lundberg asked me to go to Canada. And I went. Became a representative to the British Columbia Seamen's Union. As my way of not facing the crisis of the bureaucracy, that is, saying no to them, saying that I will not become an organizer for Union Oil and so on. Remember, this is a closed shop. All hiring goes through the hiring hall, and you can be hurt badly if you're in open opposition to these people and you don't have a following. And that was my case. So I took the job to Canada, and that got me away from any more organizing for Standard Oil, or for the SUPSIU.
For Standard Oil.
At Standard, that was all over. Now comes Union Oil, that's coming up, and I know that's going to be dirty, and I don't want any part of that. I don't want any. So I did a very good job of cleaning up the guy. There was a guy who was really corrupt, who was running the British Columbia Seamen's Union up here. And I did a good enough job that Lundberg turned me into the immigration. And I had to take a pierhead jump in Seattle to get out of that situation.
He turned you into what, Canadian immigration?
Yeah.
As being what, illegally up to
yes,
Canada?
Yes, yes, yes. I never could prove that, except that I had a guy tell me that who was out of the hall, out of the headquarters.
So at this point, you find yourself at odds with your union.
I never took a job for a union again.
You never took a job for the...
For any union.
Oh, for any union.
I was never a member of any labor bureaucracy in any way. I had taken that job at Standard Oil as an innocent, rank and file on the job organizer. And they were pulling me into the staff. That was the logical next step, payroll staff organizer. And I didn't want to tell them, screw you, because that would have been the end of my livelihood. And so I lived to finally fight them on the basis, on fight their racism openly. At the end of World War II, toward the end of World War II, so many blacks had come on the waterfront during World War II, that the Sailors Union, Lundberg leadership, realized that everything had changed. That here were all these blacks on the waterfront. And this was a lily white stronghold. Well, no African Americans at all. So the Coast Committee met and came up with a policy. And Maxie Kornblatt, who was an ex-Wobbly, and really a tough and wonderful guy in many ways, was the reporter for them on the question of race. And he got up in a meeting and read that checkerboarding, that is mixing races, integrating ships, causes friction on ships. And we don't want to do that. So we will remain free from checkerboarding as long as the membership wants it that way. The day the membership votes to integrate the checkerboard, we'll go along. We're the leadership because we're a democratic union.
Did these ever come up for a referendum votes on integration?
No, we were to vote that night by hand in the hall, in the headquarters, and all up and down the coast at the same time. So I hit the floor. I said, the Coast Committee's report solves nothing. The blacks are here, and it's true, as you have said, that the ILWU has used blacks politically for their own purposes. But what choice do the black longshoremen and seamen have but to go to unions like the ILWU and the NMU? They get used by those unions because they can't get in this union. We keep them out.
How are the blacks being used by the ILWU, longshoremen, and the NMU?
Here, the ILWU, for example, is not segregated at all. As a matter of fact, it's rapidly integrating, very rapidly. In the war years, it became half black, from 5% to 55% black. At the same time, there were unions that, like the IAM, that had a separate and segregated local. The Boilermakers had a separate and segregated local for blacks. Now, here are blacks seeing that the ILWU is not Jim Crowing them. And they felt obligated to that leadership. And the leadership was making sure they felt obligated for this. And so it became very difficult for blacks to vote critically against Bridges policies at any point. As a matter of fact, in 1960s and 50s, and the first B list on the waterfront, we were fighting that. And it is the fathers and the uncles of the blacks on the 59 B list, the second class citizen, non-union longshoremen full time, made non-union by the union. The sons and nephews were fighting their fathers, their black fathers and black uncles, telling them, you're not obligated to him. You worked for every penny you got in your paycheck down here. He didn't pay. You earned it. You don't have to stick with him on this question of M&M agreements and of two classes of citizenship on the waterfront, A and B.
Yeah. During the World War II, Bridges, you think there's a shortage of laborers for waterfront work, and or was there a shortage of laborers for waterfront work?
I don't know about longshore, what the shortage was. Probably there was, but I'm not certain of that. A lot of the left-wing politicals who were pro-CP volunteered for the armed forces. And there were more people needed than before on the waterfront. So the bulk of these black men who came into the San Francisco Local 10 were from the rural areas of Louisiana. Probably a vast majority who made it into the ILWU were from the rural areas of Louisiana. And within a couple of years, they were experienced.
With Bridges' background in IWW, do you think that his attitude about blacks in the union was part of the IWW preamble that said, you know, all men are equal and we want to, unlike the AFL, we want to organize all people? Do you think he just simply was using?
I think there was racism in the IWW too. I don't think that most of the IWWs that I knew were not militant anti-racists. This coast was sort of all the maritime labor was Scandinavian or Finnish, and this is the way life was, sort of naturally out of the woods up north onto the lumber schooners and so on. They were recruited, and I don't think that for one moment that Bridges carried with him any of real influence from the IWW. He was disciplining ILWU members in as early as 36, before even leaving the ILA, disciplining his own membership for taking job action. Remember that the 34th strike occurred during the third period of the Comintern, the ultra-left period. After 36, it was the Popular Front period, which is a very conservative type of period. And Bridges was acting very conservatively and never acted like a syndicalist, if he ever did. Never again, not after after the 34th strike, one would have to manufacture things almost to show that he acted in a syndicalist manner. He was a political being, and he was motivated throughout his life by his belief that Russia was socialist.
Yeah. I want to shift gears a little bit here and go back to World War II. During World War II, did you make port in L.A.? Did you get any time to come home?
Yeah. I several times. On the East Coast, no. When I was still on the East Coast, of course, too hard to get home. But I hitchhiked 6 times across the country. To get home and back to a ship in New York or Norfolk.
Or a hitch instead of get a ship, I guess.
Well, yeah. You didn't know where any of the ships were going. That was all secret. The only way you knew, the only way to get to New York, really and truly, was bum, or get a train, and that was pretty expensive.
That sounds like quite an adventure, hitchhiking across the country.
Well, it wasn't difficult. It was part of the subculture to hitchhike at that time, and the people picked you up with ease, and they weren't afraid of you. And only once did a guy picked me up who was a used car dealer moving from Ohio to L.A., and I got in his car, and he pulled a gun on me right away, and he said, "I don't want any funny business during this trip." He says, "I got a long ride here, and you can go all the way with..." He took me to my grandmother's door in Los Angeles.
Why would he have pulled a gun on you?
He was afraid, and he was trying to intimidate anybody who might hurt him, yeah.
So, on your time off in L.A. during the war, do you recall do you remember anything about the suit drives in Los Angeles?
Well, yeah, I didn't witness the specific riot or anything like that. I was gone. But already, when I was going to dances in L.A. before the war got started, there was all this friction. You couldn't get in the Palladium if your coat went beyond the tip knuckle in your third finger. It went lower than that. And we had some fights in this basis. But I remember we paid off a ship in New York City. We were delivering a Down East fishing schooner back to Best Foods from San Francisco. It had been a mine trawler. We went to Boston with it. And two guys, there was a Mexican kid and a very light-skinned black kid. They were all maybe 19, each of them. And when we got to New York, the first thing that the black kid did was go and buy a pork pie hat and a real zoot suit in Harlem. And we met in the Sailors Hall, and it was a red-headed guy in the crew. And he pulled me and the Mexican American kid aside, and he didn't know that the Mexican American and the light-skinned black guy, both from West Oakland, were buddies. He says, "I don't understand you guys going around with blacks." With Negroes, he was showing us some courtesy, and he says, "Geez, look at the way that guy dresses." He says, "So and so," he called him by name, just like that. He says, "You guys talk like you'd even be seen with them on the street." And we said yes, and he was aghast at our calmness and all this. But what had antagonized him to finally come out with his racism, this other redheaded guy, was the way our friend from West Oakland was dressing. Had the suit he had bought. And he caulked his hair and the whole thing. He got a gas job, as a matter of fact, in Oakland, in Harlem.
A gas job?
Yeah, that was the term used then for hair straightening.
Oh. So, when you were in L.A., did you notice L.A. changing much during the war?
Well, my grandmother had owned that house in East L.A. on Alma Street, and they started building the Santa Ana Freeway. And our house was right in the path of it. So they told my grandmother, move, and here's the money. And so my grandmother moved to the Atwater District, between Glendale and Frogtown. Between Riverside Drive and San Fernando Drive, and made that the new family home. And it was amazing. I should have seen it even more clearly then, but now it's possible to look back and see that she's the one. She, with her Sunday dinners and the hard work that she did constantly, she was a slave to the family, just like to the rich people she always worked for. And she got us all in the same place every Sunday. It was George then, my Uncle George, who then got the family doing things, created a family subculture. But she's the one who had the hall, had the chairs, had the tables, had the silverware, and the good roast beef and the Yorkshire pudding and apple pies.
Is that where you would stay when you would be home?
My mother had finally moved away from my grandmother's house for the first time in her life, except for a brief period when she was first married. At the age of 40 some, she moved out and got her own apartment. And so I would stay at my mother's place or with a girlfriend. I was going with a girl I had met on the west side, and I was walking with my mother downtown by Pershing Square, and I said, wait here, there was a bookstore right on Pershing Square, I've forgotten the name of it, a big one, it's still in some other part of town, they moved. I said, wait here, I'm going over to Biltmore and I'm going to get a room for the night. She said, who for? I said, myself and Roberta. And she said, that poor little girl. My mother had very backward attitudes. But she finally was liberated. She married a second time and married a black man, black musician, pretty famous one, Albert Nicholas. Mm-hmm. New Orleans
jazz man.
Creole jazz, Dixieland jazz. Played a great clarinet.
When did she get married?
Well, I guess that was about 1943 or 4.
Did she work for the LeBarons the entire?
No. When the war started, she got out and got her own dress shop and did well in Eagle Rock with her dress shop, right, not too far from where she was living, and.
She married a black man. Did that shock anybody else in the family? Say it.
I was the only one in the family who knew.
Oh, no. Your uncles didn't know?
She kept out. She knew that they would be beyond saving on this question.
Did and they never found out?
Never found out, to my knowledge.
Oh, that's strange.
Yeah. Because my mother had married Albert Nicholas, a black man, for the first time she felt some kind of kindred feelings for my radicalization, my becoming a socialist. Because she sensed, knew of course, that socialists would defend an interracial marriage. And very few people she knew would defend an interracial marriage, that is vocally come out and say this is the right that people have.
When exactly have you become a socialist?
In the early part of 1943, I had come back from the East Coast, and I got on a ship, a C-1, the Mormick Lark, for the Mormick-Cormick Steamship Company. They were fast ships compared to Liberty. They do 15 knots. And we were going to go to Australia, and we did go to Australia. And there was, we lacked one AB, one able-bodied seaman, and to make the trip. I was deck delegate already. We had a good bosun. And we were working in the foredeck before lunch, before noontime.